Hi, this is Beth Golay. Before we get started with my conversation with John Green, here is a quick message from one of our other podcasts.
We return to one of our favorite topics on the latest You're Saying It Wrong podcast as we talk about words you sometimes use even though you maybe kind of don't really know what they mean. Ironically, even we struggle with some of these. Wait, is that ironic? You're Saying It Wrong. Find it at KMUW.org or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
This is Marginalia, a production of KMUW Wichita.
Marginalia. Notes in the margin of a book.
Notes, commentary, and similar material written in the margin of a book.
Comments and notes which are incidental or additional
to the main topic.
The main topic in the margin of a book.
When you hear the name John Green, you might think of him as a vlog brother with his brother, Hank. Or you might recall that he wrote the book The Fault in Our Stars, which was made into a movie. Or you might remember that he wrote other books, Turtles All the Way Down, Paper Towns, and An Abundance of Catherines. But my earliest memory of John Green was in April of 2005. He had just published his debut novel for young adults, Looking for Alaska.
My book hadn't even come out yet, right?
Actually, it had just been released, and I was one of seven booksellers and librarians visiting with John Green at a restaurant in Kansas City.
You remember the first few days of your life as an author with much more clarity than you remember the next 15 years.
I was an early fan. I read all of the books I just mentioned. I would spew quotes from An Abundance of Catherines to unsuspecting victims. And then after all of the success with his novels, John Green decided to write a book of essays with a title that I can pronounce now, but when I spoke with John, it was not pretty. So you probably know that everything I learn from reading, so I'm the queen of mispronunciation.
Me too.
Which brings me to my first question, and it's Anthropocene. No, wait. Anthropocene. It's Anthropocene. I'm Beth Golay, this is Marginalia, and here's my conversation with John Green about The Anthropocene Reviewed. It is Anthropocene, right?
I don't think there is a standardized pronunciation of the word Anthropocene yet, because it's still only a proposed geologic term, like it hasn't been widely agreed to. And I've heard Anthropocene, I say Anthropocene, but I also come from the American South, so I put the emphasis on the first syllable almost all the time. So I say umbrella and insurance. And so I say Anthropocene, but I have no idea if that's correct.
Well, I was going to say, thank God there's a podcast to tell me how to say it, but then I butchered it even after that. And I'll get to the podcast in a minute. But first, I was wondering if you could define it for our readers and our listeners.
Yeah, the Anthropocene is a proposed term for the current geologic age, the age at which we as a species have become a geologically significant phenomenon. I mean, we are so powerful as a species now that we have radically reshaped Earth's biodiversity. We are reshaping Earth's climate. We are making huge, long-lasting interventions into the landscape. And so some geologists argue that we are now living in a new geologic age in which we are sort of, for better or worse, the protagonists. And I wanted to write about that and write about how strange it is to live in this moment when humans are at once far too powerful and not nearly powerful enough, right? Like, we are far too powerful in the sense that we can reshape that biodiversity of our planet. But we are also so powerless and so vulnerable and so frail that we can be brought to our knees by a single strand of RNA. And it's a very weird time to be alive in that way.
And then talk to me about the review system, this five-star system.
Before I was a writer, I was a book reviewer. And so before I was a novelist, I was a book reviewer. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about book reviewing because I did it so much. I reviewed hundreds of books for Booklist magazine in the early 2000s when I worked there. And in the years after I was a book reviewer, suddenly everyone became a reviewer and everything became a subject for review. You know, like, it wasn't just that people were reviewing books and movies, people were reviewing haircuts and restaurants and national parks. And alongside this growing review database rose the five-star scale. And we depend so much on the five-star scale, but we think about it almost never. Like, it basically didn't exist in any sort of cultural society-wide way until the rise of the internet, because like the five-star scale doesn't exist for us. It exists for data aggregation systems, and it's much easier for those systems to take a single point of data than it is to like read a 200-word review and try to conclude what it means. And so we've become like hugely dependent on this scale that we never think about. And so when I was writing these essays, my initial thought in conversation with my brother years ago when I first started writing these was, it's so weird that, you know, people review their haircuts and they review parks. Why don't we review Canada geese? Why don't I review plague? And that's kind of where the initial idea for the book came from.
And so the book began as a podcast in 2018. Readers were used to your fiction, assuming you were writing about yourself in code, but now we're listening to and reading John Green. And, you know, that's true, isn't it? This is so personal in a way that your fiction isn't.
Yes, it's very far more personal. I mean, when I'm writing novels, I'm not really writing for or about myself. I'm trying to write for other people, and I'm trying also to write about other people. I'm trying to imagine what it's like, what it might be like to be someone other than myself. And that's a big part of the pleasure of writing fiction for me, is that it's almost a way of escaping this strange situation I'm in, where I'm stuck for the whole time I'm here inside of one particular consciousness and one particular body. And that can be pretty stressful for me at times. So that's one thing I really love about writing fiction, but partly because of this historical moment and partly because I had just, I guess, kind of tired of, like you said, writing in code, I wanted to try to write directly about myself and my experience and what the world looks like for me. And it is the first time I've tried to do that in any kind of formal way. And it's scary. I mean, it's far more vulnerable than writing fiction. But it was also just hugely fun to work on this book, not least because I was kind of writing it for myself.
You know, in this book, you reviewed the half title page. You have two half title pages, one blank and one with a review. So why only the 2.5 stars?
Man, there's a lot of little Easter egg reviews in the book because this is my sixth book, and I love bookmaking, and I love the process of how books get printed and learning about that and working with the printer really closely to make a beautiful book. And one of the things that drives me absolutely crazy about publishing is they insist upon these half title pages, which in my opinion are no longer in any way essential to the bookmaking process. It's just like another page at the beginning of the book that tells you nothing but the title, which you already know from looking at the cover or from looking at like literally any page of the book. So I wanted to, I couldn't get them to not do the half title pages. So I wanted to at least express my discontent with them.
Now, these are not uninformed opinions. It seems like you do extensive research and then opine. And I'm curious about your topics. How do you choose? I mean, do you write about whatever makes you curious? I mean, what an amazing rabbit hole it must have been to discover that there's no period after the Doctor in Dr. Pepper.
Yeah, that's a great example of where, you know, inquiry and curiosity just take you to unexpected places, and you learn the reason why there's no period in Dr. Pepper, and it's fascinating, and I wanted to write about that. I think for me, it was a mix of thinking about the things I use all the time or benefit from all the time, but don't spend much time thinking about. Dr. Pepper is an example. I drink like one or two Diet Dr. Peppers a day every day, and I spend almost no time thinking about Diet Dr. Pepper. And in fact, I didn't know the history of Diet Dr. Pepper until I began researching it. But then I'm also fascinated by things that I know I'll never see. And I know that I will never be able, like places I know I'll never be able to go to. So for instance, I wrote a review of this extinct bird species called the Kauai o'o. And I wanted to write about that precisely because I knew that I could never experience the song of a Kauai o'o up close or see the bird in real life. And so it's a mix of wanting to pay attention to what's all around me all the time, and also wanting to pay attention to stuff that I've maybe neglected and not done a good job of paying attention to.
You know, some of your topics hit close to home though, and sometimes they can be comforting. And I'm thinking about your essay, Humanity's Temporal Range. Well, You know, at the same time, I was wondering where the Chinese rocket was going to land when you're talking about extinction. And so you mentioned in this essay, talking to your brother Hank about the pandemic, and his answer to you was, the species will survive this. And so I'm wondering, are the essays comforting to you? Do you find comfort in the writing of them?
I do find comfort in the writing of them. I mean, the thing that is extremely important to me, and not in like a philosophical or abstract way, but that is important, critical to my ability to go on, is to find hope, and to find hope that stands up to the reality of suffering and the reality of injustice, that doesn't deny those realities or minimizes them, but still makes an argument that is a hopeful argument about ourselves as individuals and about our species as a whole. And I think the main reason I really wanted to write this book was because I wanted to write, I guess, a defense of hope for myself as much as for anyone else. This has been such a hard year. I mean, such a hard year and a half, such a hard 5 years for me in a lot of ways. And I felt like I needed to do that for myself. I needed to explore the history of our species, but I also needed to explore my personal history, to find those light-soaked memories that are worth fighting for, to believe again in the possibility of light-soaked days in my future. I just needed that. And so that's really why I wrote the book, was because I wanted to go back to believing that hope is the correct response to the strange, sometimes terrifying miracle of consciousness.
You know, I was beginning to wonder if you ever gave 5-star reviews. And then you gave me Sunsets. So
yeah.
Why does Sunset get a 5-star?
Well, the first half of the book, nothing gets 5 stars. And I guess the idea in my mind at the time was that, well, nothing's perfect, you know, and nothing really deserves an unambiguous recommendation. And that's so ludicrous. Like, that's just wrong. And the truth is that so much is perfect, that the beauty in the world is really, really beautiful, and it is worth celebrating. And the beauty in us is really beautiful and is worth celebrating. And the fact that there is other stuff that is also true, the fact that, you know, there is horrifying injustice, there is, you know, abject suffering that we will all live with, that's true. But there are also still 5-star moments and 5-star experiences in life. And, you know, for much of my life, I've kind of worn this armor of irony and cynicism, I think, to protect myself from the world somehow, to try to, you know, make sure that I never get hit where I'm really earnest. And Sunsets just unwind that for me. Like, I find that they are just so overwhelmingly beautiful that, despite the fact that they're also hugely cliched and a little bit over the top sometimes, you know, like, I'm a Midwesterner. Like, I over the top beauty makes me uncomfortable. And so sometimes when I'm looking at a sunset, I'll be like, ah, it's a little much. But I just have to open myself up to that beauty, and I have to really let it affect me and let it move me. And that's what I wanted to write that essay about.
One of your essays is titled Jerzy Dudek's Performance on May 25th, 2005. And it's about an unlikely Polish football goalie and his rise from coal mine worker to game-winning star on the Liverpool team. And you write, and I quote, "Someone tell 21-year-old Jerzy Dudek, playing for $1,800 a year, that he's a decade away from lifting the European Cup." And I thought, you know, this in a way sounds a little bit like your trajectory. I mean, someone tell 27-year-old John Green, sitting in a restaurant in Kansas City talking about his first book with booksellers and librarians, that he's not even a decade away from being beloved by millions. So talk to me about this quote, which was also in the essay. "You can't see the future coming, not the terrors for sure, but you also can't see the wonders that are coming, the moments of light-soaked joy that await each of us."
I really believe that. And, you know, when I feel discouraged, I feel like it's permanent. You know, when I'm hurting, when I'm experiencing intense psychic pain, it feels like it's the only truth that will ever be true. And it's not. It's not. Now feels like forever, but it isn't. And it never is. You know, there's a Liberian proverb, no condition is permanent. And it's true. It's true in the good ways and it's true in the bad ways. And so when I was writing that essay, I was, you know, writing it amid the depths of the pandemic, really not knowing how or when we would get out of this, you know, not having been able to see my parents in many months, feeling very disconnected from people I loved. And I wanted to write that essay partly because I kept imagining in my mind, I kept seeing in my mind the image of Jerzy Dudek running to his teammates and how they embraced him. And when I would rewatch that game, which I have rewatched probably like 1200 times in my life, when I would rewatch that game, I would think about that every time, how like in time, I also will embrace the people I love and, you know, this isn't final.
This is silly, but as I was reading your essays, I kept thinking about all of the places you've lived, because you've lived in Florida, Alabama, Chicago, New York. And a part of me was jealous because I live 30 minutes away from my childhood home, 30 minutes away. And I've never lived anywhere else except two other places, which are even closer to my childhood home. And I was jealous, but then I read your essay titled Indianapolis. And that piece is a little bit about perspective, isn't it?
Yeah, I wanted to write about, I mean, Indianapolis is objectively not a great city, but it's my hometown and I love it very, very much. And part of the reason I love it is because it's not easy or straightforward to love. Like anybody can fall in love with Los Angeles, you know, like it's not difficult. It's, you know, you have to pay a different kind of attention to fall in love with a city like Indianapolis. And certainly when we first moved here, I was really resentful. I've always been the trailing spouse in our marriage. So wherever Sarah got a job, we would go there. And, you know, she's a museum curator. So I kind of thought that we would just go from amazing city to amazing city. Like we went from Chicago to New York. And then I thought maybe we'll go to Paris or Amsterdam. But instead she got a job in Indianapolis. And initially I was pretty bummed out about it. I didn't have any friends. I didn't get what was interesting about the city. It just seemed like endless suburban sprawl and like flat roofed soulless mini malls. And it really took some time to fall in love with it. But the love I've found for the city is so deep because it took time. And because I wasn't doing a good job of appreciating what really is extraordinary about Indianapolis. I mean, it's an extraordinarily diverse city. It's a city of, great and terrible history. And most of all, it's a place where real people's real lives take place. And I think sometimes we forget about that when we're thinking about, well, this city is cool and this city isn't cool. Like really places are about people.
You know, when I met you in 2005, I learned at that time that you were a theology major, but I didn't remember that you were also an English major. And I was wondering, as I read the book, I had to go look that up because, you know, you read a lot of books for Booklist, but there were so many book references throughout your essays. And you're just very well read. I'm not sure if it was because of Booklist or because you're an English major or because you continue to read. So I'm wondering, now that you're not reading books to review them, I'm curious about your reading life. I mean, how do you decide what to read and how much to read? How much do you read?
I wish I were a little more intentional about how I read. I mostly read stuff because I read a good review or because a friend recommends it to me, which I think is how most of us discover books. Or I hear an interview, you know, on NPR that I really like, and I think like, oh, I'd like to read that book. But I do love reading, and it has been a great solace to me ever since I was a little kid. And it remains essentially the same gift to me that it was when I was nine, which is that it's a way to escape myself and it's a way to not be inside of my particular consciousness for a while and to try to imagine what it's like to be someone else or to try to learn something about the world around me. And then ever since I was little, I've kept quotes. You know, I keep a little, now it's a Google Doc, but originally it was just like a piece of paper, a series of pieces of paper where I write down little lines from books that stick with me. And a lot of those did find their way into the Anthropocene Reviewed book. And, you know, and a lot of it's poetry because I love reading poetry, and I can't write poetry, but I also feel like there are probably not enough people out there who are like me who just like love reading poetry and can't don't write any. But I love reading poetry, and so a lot of it also, I think, was, you know, I felt like there were all these people who'd said what I wanted to say better than I could ever say it, and so why not just hand the microphone over to them?
I posted on our station Facebook page that I was going to be talking to you and asked if anybody had questions for you, and I have a couple. One of the questions is from Kate. It's kind of a two-part question. She wants to know how you and Hank's companies, have your companies impacted how you view modern culture?
Yeah, for sure. I mean, we work with a lot of young people on the educational video series that we make, Crash Course and SciShow and the other ones. And that's affected how I view culture, because it's a great gift to, you know, be in the presence of young people who have a very different set of experiences from the ones that I have and who are pushing culture forward. And I mainly feel like my job is to not get in the way. Like I don't want to stop the, you know, the movement toward a more interesting and just world.
You know, she also wants to know about why you both donate so much to the charities, including founding a hospital in Africa. And I did visit with Hank about both of his novels recently.
Oh, cool.
Yes. And he, I have to tell you, just from reading your essays and then and visiting with him, the love you two have for each other is really remarkable. And it's really a beautiful thing.
Thank you.
So he mentioned all of the work that you all do in Africa. And I wanted to give you that same platform, that same opportunity to spread this beautiful word.
Yeah, there's a maternal health crisis in Sierra Leone, especially, but in many countries in West Africa. Maternal death in Sierra Leone is 500 to 700 times higher than it is in the US. And we don't need to accept that. And it isn't inevitable. And we know it isn't inevitable because we've seen lots of other healthcare systems get stronger. And as they get stronger, more people survive childbirth and more kids survive to adulthood. And so we've been supporting Partners in Health and the Sierra Leonean Ministry of Health in the building of a maternal center of excellence and a neonatal intensive care unit in the Kono district in Sierra Leone for the last several years. And they just broke ground, which is really exciting, despite all the challenges of COVID. You know, the Ministry of Health and PIH have been working so hard to make this happen. And, you know, we're a small part of that story. And I kind of frankly feel like people who fund charity projects get way too much credit, and the people who actually do the work don't get nearly enough credit, but we're happy to try to do our part.
Okay, so then also Larry asks, how important are personal actions compared to policy changes in the fight for human survival?
That's a great question. I mean, the biggest stuff that we do together. And this is something I really wanted to write about a lot in the Anthropocene Reviewed book. We tend to celebrate the stories of heroic individuals with their amazing accomplishments, but almost always people are participating in much larger systems. You know, like Thomas Edison was a hugely important figure in the development of electricity. And we have all these debates over who invented the light bulb. And I understand why we have those debates. But what's interesting to me is not the light bulb, it's the electricity grid. Like, the electricity grid is an astonishment. And it's the reason that light bulbs work. And millions of people over 100 years have been working together to build and maintain that grid. And so I think that we need to view the big human stories as what they are, which is big human collaborations. Personal choice makes a huge difference in the lives of individuals, and it can also make a big difference in the life of a community. I don't want to minimize that, but we really need to be thinking about what we are doing together and what we can do together better.
Is there anything that you want to talk about that I haven't asked?
Oh gosh, the questions, I don't think so. It's been very lovely.
Oh, thank you.
It's nice. I mean, it's nice to talk to somebody who definitely read the book.
That was John Green, author of the book, The Anthropocene Reviewed, which was published by Dutton. Thanks for joining us for Marginalia. If you enjoyed this episode, please give it one of those reviews. Marginalia was produced at KMUW Wichita. Our engineers are Mark Statzer and Torrin Anderson. Our editor is Luann Stevens, and our producer is Haley Krausen. This is Marginalia, and for KMUW, I'm Beth Golay.